Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Sylvie Rivera, a member of the club's Asia-Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. John Needers. Over 30 years ago, I tried Chinese medicine as a last resort. The results changed the course of my life. This is the opening quote on Dr. Needers' website profile. The list of accomplishments that appear on his resume proves that these 30 years have been studious and productive. Amongst others, I will cite Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine, licensed acupuncturist, host of The Balancing Point, a weekly health radio show. Dr. Needers pursued extensive postgraduate training. He is a diplomat, National Board of Acupuncture Orthopedics. He completed certifications in gynecology and internal medicine at Zhejiang Chinese Medical University in China, and was with the first group of American acupuncturists to be certified in integrated diabetes prevention and treatment at the Tsinghua Hospital in China. Tonight, against the backdrop of a heated public debate about healthcare in the U.S., Dr. Needers will give us an introduction to this more than 2,000 years old traditional medicine, the theoretical and scientific basis for its effectiveness. And, inspired by his clinical experience in China, will explain how such an integrative healthcare system can create greater health at much reduced cost. Please join me in welcoming Dr. John Needers.
Thank you, Sylvie. Thank you for coming out. I feel extremely honored to be asked to speak here. And it's a little different audience for me, which is very fun. As Sylvie mentioned, I do a radio show, a weekly radio show. And one of the fun things about that is that people can't see me. So this is a little different. And you can't, you know, when I'm behind the scenes, I can make faces and do all sorts of things. So I'll try to remember that I'm live tonight, but please excuse me if I forget. Listening to the introduction, at first I was honored, and then I realized that what it really meant is that I'm very old. And that's what kept coming through. And, of course, Lynn reminded me of that today when she said, I thought you might dress up. And I said, I did. I wore my bolo. And she said, yeah, my grandfather used to wear one of those, too. Thanks. So, one of the things, I'm rather notorious for preparing at the last minute and for being asked to speak at functions and scribbling notes while I'm in the audience. And this time I broke the mold and I created a presentation actually a couple months ago. So, of course, last night I had to stay up and change it completely. And that was part of the change was really in light of the recent vote in the House on healthcare reform. And there are certain things that are happening in healthcare reform that we're certainly aware of, but there are other things I think are being overlooked on a level that's potentially catastrophic. And one of those things in general that is not, in my opinion, being addressed in any significant manner is the fact that there are systems of medicine in the world that provide as good and in some cases better. You know, there's some good and some bad with almost any system that you find, whether it's healthcare, political systems, whatever. But in many ways, the Chinese government provides better health care, or the Chinese people provide better health care for $277 a year than we get for almost $7,500 a year. So that's 20 times the expenditure. And I promise you, if you spend some time in a Chinese health care clinic in that setting, you'll see that we do not get 20 times the value. Now, some of those things are not things that will change. Their wage structure is lower. Medical doctors in China make a lower wage. There are many other factors. However, most of the savings are not found in those areas. Most of those savings, at least 50%, are found in areas that we could change within 6 months. 6 months, if there were the political will to do so, and not the partisan debates that are occurring that are avoiding the 900-pound gorilla in the corner. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that, but I am going to stick to the topic a little bit. And I'm going to start out talking about a little history of traditional, TCM means traditional Chinese medicine. So I will abbreviate that a bit so I didn't have to write out traditional Chinese medicine. I'm going to give you a very, very short history. Again, those of you that know me know that I can talk for weeks on just about any subject. So I'm going to really have to squeeze a lot in here. So the history won't really be very long. I'm going to talk about what is TCM. And the second part is extremely important because I'm going to take a short look at the difference between education and propaganda. Now, propaganda has a very negative connotation, but propaganda simply means to propagate one's own position. And what I'm going to talk about tonight is that we are a propaganda-driven medical system. That means there are very clear vested interests who have a position that they push to the forefront that drowns out other things. So we'll talk a little bit about that, or I will talk a little bit about that. Talk a little bit about how Chinese medicine is currently practiced in the U.S. A bit more about how it's practiced in China so you can see the difference. And how this could save us about 50% in our healthcare costs. Now, Chinese medicine is the oldest continuously practiced system of medicine in the world. And now it's completely different from Chinese folk medicine. And if you were to hear many people speak about Chinese medicine, they speak about it as though it is a folk medicine. There is at least as much science now supporting traditional Chinese medicine as there is supporting Western biomedicine. And I could go into hours of discussion about those issues, but it's very clear. Although Chinese medicine is a pre-scientific system, again, we have to remember that science is one of those magic words that gets thrown out, like liberal, conservative, propaganda, science. Right? Is it scientific? Well, most people really aren't even clear what science is. Science just is a methodology. It's the scientific method. And when you look through how many studies are done that are supposed to be scientific, they're really very poor science. And we'll actually talk about a few of those studies tonight. Again, biomedicine in the U.S. is not considered a folk medicine, but it too arose out of folk medicine systems. The estimate is 25% of all the medications currently used in the U.S. came out of herbal, primarily folk medicines. They were things that worked, so they were adopted by they were investigated by the pharmaceutical industry. If they could make a drug out of it, then it was sold to the public. Now, many, many things that are very effective treatments for a variety of medical conditions will never, ever be used for those conditions. Okay? In the United States, the only thing that can, and this is very different than other countries, the only thing that can legally be used to cure a disease is a drug. So if it's not a drug, if it hasn't gone through the FDA approval process, it cannot be a cure for a disease. Well, that's kind of an interesting concept because it leaves a whole range of other things out that the Western medical community knows work, but they can't use them. One of the classic examples is a tropical shrub called graviola. Graviola is being studied in dozens of medical hospitals, Duke University, several other hospitals. Many pharmaceutical companies are investigating graviola because it is known to have about 1,000 times the effectiveness that some chemotherapy drugs have. It is 1,000 times more effective. But you will never see graviola used as an anti-cancer medication because the pharmaceutical companies haven't been able to find the one alkaloid that they can convert to a patentable medicine, right? Because you're not going to patent something. For example, you're not going to patent vitamin C. You can't. It's a naturally occurring substance. So nobody will ever do studies to prove or validate, for example, vitamin C as a medicine. They also won't do that with graviola because they can't extract the one patentable item. Okay? For example, another example of that is Lipitor, the first really of the statin drugs, is a derivative of red yeast rice. Well, red yeast rice could not be patented because it's a natural product, so they had to extract from it Lipitor, and then that could be patented because it can cost $1 million, $750,000 to get through that patenting process, and you're not going to do that unless you have the rights to that product. So when we look at this issue of medicines, it's important to realize that. Now, again, Chinese medicine is the oldest continuously practiced form of medicine. There were universities with very, very stringent entrance exams going back about 1,500 years. The classic work of Chinese medicine was called the Huangdi Neijing, the Yellow Emperor's Classic of Medicine. And this was really the very, very seminal work. And it was attributed to Emperor Huangdi. He didn't actually write it. In fact, he wasn't alive at the time it was written. But in that culture, any great classic is attributed to someone that is already famous. So it's just a cultural issue. So there are lots of estimates, but it was probably written about 2,500 years ago. And I promise, if you were to pick up a copy of the Huangdi that's a good translation, it would astound you. The amount of wisdom in that book that is being validated every day, every week, every month by biomedicine, Western biomedicine. So in the Huangdi Neijing, the Chinese system based their medical system on observations of people and on observations of their environment. One of the things that we often forget is that human beings really didn't move indoors till fairly recently. We didn't have artificial light until a few hundred years ago, and we didn't have electricity until about 100 years ago. And so people lived very differently. They lived in harmony with their environment because they didn't have any choice, right? When it was dark, you went to bed. When the sun came up, you got up. You ate seasonally. You ate different food in the spring, then you ate in the summer, then you ate in the fall, then you ate in the winter. And all of Chinese medicine is based on those simple, simple principles that have always been accurate, are accurate now, and will probably be accurate until we go through huge mutation. But, we may adapt to eating GMO corn. I don't know. I don't know if we will adapt to the other things that are happening, but we haven't done it yet. One of the things that people are familiar with is this idea of yin and yang. And yin and yang is often misunderstood. When we look at Chinese philosophy and Chinese medicine, yin and yang is not oppositional. There's not something is yin and something is yang. Everything in the universe has some combination of yin and yang. Every woman in this audience has male hormones, as well as female hormones. Every man in this audience has female hormones as well as male hormones. The difference is the men will generally have more yang hormones, more male hormones, and less female hormone. But even that will change during your life. And so it's this interplay of forces that the Chinese were so interested and concerned with, because that's what determines health. And again, this is really what Einstein, I think, was saying. You're looking at energy and mass being an equivalency. They're the same, except for the amount of energy in the system. So we're looking here at yang and yin and the conversion back and forth. It's interesting, Heisenberg, who's famous for the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and for which basically says we don't know anything, and then he was famous for creating binary language or utilizing it for the computer systems. I don't know if this is true, but my physics professor, not knowing that I was involved in Chinese medicine, said that Heisenberg received his Nobel Prize wearing a yin-yang T-shirt. And he says that he didn't invent anything at all. He just borrowed this from the Chinese and their idea of yin and yang. And most of you are familiar with this symbol. So you have the yin and yang in the center. This is the interplay of light and dark. And as the yang gets stronger, the yin diminishes, but it never goes away completely. In fact, in the center of the whiteness is darkness, and in the center of darkness is white. Around it, those figures, which you can see a little better here, are called trigrams. And this is binary language. You notice there are only two possibilities. You either have a straight line or you have a broken line. And how you put those together is symbolic in China and in Chinese medicine. And all Chinese medicine is essentially based on this when you get down to it. When these are combined into six character sets, it becomes a hexagram, and then you have 64 possibilities. So you're looking at this buildup of binary language and binary thought. I just threw this one in because it was fun. Essentially, you know, when I teach nutrition, we look at this a lot, and it's really on the left, you've got this balance. We call it jing-o-matic, right? And jing is vital life force. It's what you, it's really your genetic endowment primarily. And you get some, according to the Chinese, if you have too much sex, if you are excessive in drinking and eating, things like that, then you lose it. There are a few things that you can do to add it, but essentially we're looking at that balance. And essentially, when you run out of jing, you're done. Now this I put in because it's a little hard to see, but this is the pyramid of healing from a Chinese medical perspective. And what you're seeing is this hierarchy from the most base elements of healing to the highest forms of healing. And the Chinese always want and are always striving for the highest and most pure forms of healing. And those are there that are, as you look toward this, it's a little hard to see on the side there, but it says self-responsibility and it's long-lasting. The things on the bottom are temporary and passive. Our medicine in the United States is based upon temporary, passive, non-accountable forms of healing, primarily. At the very bottom of this, you have legal drugs, illegal drugs, mood enhancers, painkillers, etc. Now, I'm not saying those don't have a place. I'm just saying they are the most gross base form of medicine when we examine it from a traditional Chinese standpoint. Above that, we have invasive equipment-based medicines. So that were things like surgery, okay? Again, surgery's great. I've had one. I was told I had to have four. I got out of the other three, and I'm doing fine. But I did have one, and there's a time for surgery. However, it is considered a very base, very gross, invasive form of medicine. Just above that, you'll notice acupuncture. The Chinese actually consider acupuncture the most base, gross form of Chinese medicine. Why? Because it's invasive. Because it is doing something to you. Again, not as invasive as a surgery, but still you don't have to take personal accountability except to get yourself to my office. But other than that, you lay on a table, you go to sleep, I put needles in you, and you wake up and blissfully float out the door, right? But so you don't have to do a lot. From there on, you actually have to do something. And so we go up through energetic and body work, herbal medicine, which is about halfway up, energetic, food medicine, and at the top you get up to meditation, lifestyle, hopefully liberation. And this is the goal of Chinese medicine. And when you go to a practitioner of Chinese medicine who is practicing according to the principles of Chinese medicine, their goal is to have you move up the pyramid, is to not have to see them. Now, I was talking to a patient this morning, and she was saying, oh, my God, is there something wrong with me? Over the last couple weeks, I'm getting all these cool sensations. You know, I'm feeling, I think it's chi. And she's talking about these sensations. I said, that's what's supposed to happen. Basically, what I'm doing is giving you a kickstart, right? You've gotten stagnant, you're not feeling that. We treat you, and then over time, your body starts to remember what it's like to feel healthy. Because we live a very stagnant lifestyle. So that's the goal of Chinese medicine, is to move you into self-awareness and self-healing. In Chinese medicine, in the U.S., unfortunately, I'm called an acupuncturist. That's because the only modality that I practice that requires a license in the state of California is sticking needles into people. The other things that I do don't require a license. Unfortunately, then, for most of the people in our culture don't realize that acupuncture is a tiny part of traditional Chinese medicine, a very tiny part. And multiple modalities of treatment, and again, my doctorate is from Five Branches University, which is named for the five branches of Chinese medicine, which are acupuncture and moxibustion. Moxibustion, just so that I don't skip over it, is using heat of a variety of sources, but generally an herbal burning blend over an acupuncture point or over an acupuncture needle to take heat directly into the body to stimulate it. And it is considered part of acupuncture. They're really not separate. Herbal medicine, nutrition, exercise, and then energetic work. That can include body work where someone's doing it to you, or medical qigong where you are moving your energy, or someone's helping you move it. And these all have long histories of scientific validity, done studies all over the world, including in the United States. I'm not going to have time to go into all of them. I'm going to stick to acupuncture and herbal medicine for a few minutes. Acupuncture, very specific, highly refined, over 100,000 volumes, and this was 10 years ago, I have no idea how many now, written in libraries, Chinese medical schools, on acupuncture. And it's based on the idea that we are energetic beings. Now, I remember, actually going back to that same physics professor, very first lecture, he said, if you took all of the matter, the solid stuff in your body, in someone's body, it would fit in a thimble. Everything else is empty space. Everything else is just energy. He also used the example. He said if you used a dime to represent the nucleus of an atom, the atom itself would be an entire football field. So everything on that football field that is not the dime is energy. That's it. Now, every medical doctor learned that their first day in physics too. The problem is by the second day they forgot it. Okay, you hear doctors and many other people decrying energy medicine. You know, what is this voodoo energy medicine? Well, we're all practicing energy medicine because you are 99.99% energy. 0.001% solid stuff. So how could acupuncture not work? How could energetic medicine not work? So, but what's happened over the years, and again, by the Wang Di Neijing 2,500 years ago, the system of acupuncture was always already very highly developed. I have one slide that's not in here of the Malta woman that has been dated at 14,000 years ago. 14,000. On the Malta woman, who's obviously in labor, you can see she's in the process of childbirth, are embedded in exact points that you would treat for labor pain, precious gems. So clearly, and the channels are outlined on her body. So at least 14,000 years ago, somebody knew to use acupuncture or acupressure, at least, for labor pain. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but a few years ago, I was just back at the Smithsonian this summer with my 7-year-old, and I finally got to see it, the Iceman. Right, maybe you can think back and remember when the Iceman was discovered. I believe it was in Switzerland, and he was a hunter-gatherer who had been injured, I think shot with an arrow, and they got his body. Well, he'd been frozen in a glacier for about 6,000 years, and they pull him out regularly and have experts look at the Iceman. And one time they pulled him out, and someone said, "Hey, you know what? Those look like acupuncture points." I said, "What do you mean?" "Well, look, if you see the tattoos on his body, I've had acupuncture, and those are acupuncture points." So they brought in an acupuncturist. He said, "Yeah, not only are those acupuncture points, do you see these other tattoos? Those are the acupuncture meridians." and I'll tell you what's wrong with the guy. So the acupuncturist told him what to look for, and he was exactly correct in diagnosing him from the tattoos on his body. So we know that acupuncture goes back at least 14,000 years and at least 6,000 years in Europe. But it was put into a codified system in about 2500 BC, I mean about 500 BC. So we know you can actually take a machine that measures resistance. You could go to your hardware store and buy an ohm meter. And if you run it over your body, it will light up on the areas that you have acupuncture channels. It will light up even more where you have an acupuncture point. And if you get a major acupuncture point, it just goes wild. Because what it's measuring is the potential for the flow of electromagnetic energy. When you have what's called a trigger point, any of you that have had a lot of pain and you had someone work on you, if you measure those points, those are the points with the least amount of electromagnetic energy. So if you want to get out of pain, you simply turn a trigger point into an acupuncture point. And you can do that with many different modalities, mostly with acupuncture, but there are other possibilities. Acupuncture in the U.S. has been practiced certainly since primarily Chinese came to the U.S., but there were other groups also. During the railroads, when they were building it, the Chinese doctors became very, very popular. And then in the gold rush, Chinese Medicine Day has been celebrated in San Francisco for about 80 years, which is very interesting because acupuncture wasn't legal until 1976. Right, and the long story about that, which would be fun to do another seminar on. But acupuncture became popularized in the U.S. when James Reston, who was the press secretary for Richard Nixon, when Nixon went over to open up China, Reston was his press secretary. He had an appendicitis when he was in China, had an appendectomy, and he wrote about it on July 26, 1971 in the New York Times because he was rather shocked. He was lying there completely awake while they took out his appendix using acupuncture for anesthesia. So needless to say, he was a believer. And unfortunately, what acupuncture became known for was anesthesia, which is a very good use, but probably 1% of what it's effective for. Currently, in California, acupuncture is a primary health care. That means you can go directly without a note from your doctor. It's a 4-year master's degree program. It only takes 3 years to get a Juris Doctor degree. Hundreds of hours of biomedical training and diagnostics. I sent 3 patients to the emergency room last month. All were admitted, all needed to be there. And unfortunately, medical doctors have no idea what our training is. In my case, since I'm a doctor of acupuncture, which is fairly rare, there are about 1% of acupuncturists fall into that category, I've had a lot of postgraduate or post-master's degree training, and I have about probably 1,500 to 2,000 hours of Western medical diagnostics. Now, most medical doctors have no idea that we have anywhere near that. One of the reasons is medical doctors have 0 hours training in Chinese medicine. They get no training. They have no idea what we do, which, as we'll see later, is rather unfortunate for our medical care system. So, again, tons of science. I'm going to go through these fairly quickly, but a couple of studies. One was the GERAC study of chronic lumbar pain. 2 R's and created. Oh, well. So they created 3 groups, and they followed them for 6 months. One group had conventional therapy. That means they had drugs, exercise, physical modalities, physical therapy, things like massage, no surgery, but everything but surgery. Second group was an acupuncture group. They got acupuncture. Third had what they call sham acupuncture, which the concept of that is actually a sham, but they did 3 groups. The conventional therapy group had a 27.4% success rate. The fake acupuncture had a 44.2% success rate. Now, it's important to understand that this sham acupuncture is impossible. They actually, by the definition of acupuncture is to put needles in someone's body. Okay? That's what they did. So they put needles in them. They just picked less than optimal acupuncture points. They were still needling the body. The Verum acupuncture had a 47.6% success rate. So if you have chronic back pain, According to this study, you are twice as likely to get relief with acupuncture as with all or any Western biomedical treatment, and all of them put together. Another study that was actually in the American Journal of Epidemiology out of Colorado, 11,000 patients, and they came up with almost the same numbers. The conventional therapy group had 26% improvement. The acupuncture group had 52% improvement. That's double. That's double from having needles stuck into them. British Medical Journal, this is one that got a lot of airtime. Patients who received two acupuncture treatments had 65% higher in vitro fertilization success. Now, y'all know how much in vitro fertilization costs? It's $8,000 to $30,000. A simple procedure is probably $6,000 to $10,000. I have patients that have spent $23,000 with the egg washing techniques going back to Colorado, and I have patients who have paid $30,000 because they got a surrogate. So it can cost $30,000. The two acupuncture treatments, $200. And you increase your odds by 65%. Now, I don't know how many of you are in business or how many of you are gamblers. Those are pretty good odds. Now, that got a lot of notice, actually. I am a co-author with someone, an acupuncturist, who is working with the fertility physicians of Northern California to replicate that study in the U.S. This was a British Medical Journal article, and the U.S. is very, they like to do their own studies. So that she's replicating that now, and hopefully we'll have the results soon. I studied with a fellow named Shi Juimin, and he's the president of a Beijing hospital for stroke care. And according to the World Health Organization, and there are standards for all forms of treatment. And the standard for stroke recovery is called the Edinburgh Scandinavian Scale. And this is used in any type of hospital for any type of treatment anywhere in the world. And his hospital had the highest rate of post-stroke recovery of any hospital of any type anywhere in the world. Their post-stroke recovery rate was 98.5%. Okay? And this is the World Health Organization. They're not big proponents of acupuncture versus other forms of medicine. This is probably as unbiased as you can get. I studied with Shi Juimin, and it was an amazing experience. And, you know, it was a clinical experience, and in the doctoral training I was doing, we would do 4 days in a row, and 2 days were taught by Western medical doctors, usually from Stanford, UC Irvine, say on stroke care. 2 days with traditional Chinese medical doctors, and it was very fun. I remember this particular day, two of the docs from Stanford had heard about him because he's gotten a little publicity, and they stayed to watch, and they wheeled a guy in who had been driven up from Los Angeles, and laid him on a table, and he couldn't move his left leg, and I believe his left arm, I don't remember, but his left leg. And so he needled him. And for stroke, for most things, acupuncture is very gentle, almost painless. Okay, some of my patients are grimacing. Almost painless, okay? But for stroke care, it is not almost painless. It's very, very intense treatment. And so I remember this guy, and Shi Juimin, there's a point behind the knee, and he's lying on his back, and he needled him, and the guy's levitated off the table, and he needled him again, and he levitated again, and he needled him the third time. And Shi Juimin said, "So how do you feel?" And he said, "I don't think I can take any more of that." He goes, "Good, get up and walk." And he did. And it was like a revival meeting, I swear. It's like all these acupuncturists cheering, and I'm standing next to the two docs from Stanford, and they're going, "What the hell just happened?" Right? It was just amazing. It was more than they could believe. But they knew it wasn't staged. They had also seen this guy and gone over his stroke care while they were doing their clinical aspects. So Shi Juimin's a pretty amazing guy in his stroke recovery system. I've used his techniques for stroke recovery, but even things as... Oh, I'm going to have to hurry. Excuse me. So, consensus statement from the NIH, acupuncture works. There are five major theories. Is that 10 minutes? Three. Oh, my God. Okay. You don't get any of the science on herbal medicine. Sorry.
That's next time.
That's next time. Let me just say that the rap that you see on Chinese medicine in terms of danger of herbs is not accurate. I have little things that I hand out to my patients that show the 15 levels of testing done on the herbs that we use. We use herbal concentrates. But what I want to really talk about right now is, can you hear me without that?
Yes.
I want to do a little vignette.
You want
oh, okay. Thank you. No, I'm okay. That's good. So I'm going to talk about really quickly what it's like to be in a Chinese gynecology clinic. So let's pretend I'm the doctor. Now, I will have seen 200,000 to 250,000 patients in my specialty. Across from me are two junior doctors, full doctors. Sitting next to me is a patient that comes in. So in the gynecology clinic, we have a patient that comes in with pelvic pain who is having fertility problems, which means she hasn't gotten pregnant in two cycles. All right? That's a major problem. She comes in, so the senior doc looks at the junior doc, says, take her in the back, do a pelvic. While she's there, they do a swab. She comes out. She says, write her lab request. She walks down to the lab, gets a hormone profile, a complete blood test, etc. Comes back in about 45 minutes with those results. Now, while she's gone, there's an entire group of women sitting over here. The privacy is different there. And so they come in one at a time while this other woman is gone, and they get taken care of, and they get their prescriptions, and they move on. 45 minutes later, this patient walks in, sits back down. The doc says, yeah, your hormone profile's off. I think you have polycystic ovaries. I want you to get an ultrasound. Doctor writes her an order. She goes down to the lab, gets an ultrasound on the spot, comes back in about 45 minutes, sits back down again while several other women have gone through. She says, oh, yeah, fallopian tubes completely blocked on this side, and you've got fluid in this side. So looks at the other docs, says, you write her, she gives her a 40-herb prescription. She says, that will clear the fluid from the fallopian tube. You're going to ovulate from that side this month, it looks like. You write her a prescription for Clomid. Take this on days 5 through 10. Come back for an injection, and we'll pop out the egg. In the meantime, you come back every 2 days for ultrasounds so that we can examine you to see what the perfect day to do that is. There's about a 70% chance this woman is going to get pregnant on her first visit to the doctor because she's had all those testing. When I see those, and actually in some cases they would go out for a hysterosalpingogram where you put dye into the fallopian tubes, and this woman already had that. So they would check that out. Now this could all happen in one day. In my practice, when I suspect that, it takes 9 months frequently to get that through the doctor, the insurance company, the lab, back to the doctor, through the insurance company. The cost of that appointment was $1.50. Okay, that's efficiency, that's effectiveness. One of the reasons they can do it, my Chinese medical card, they have complete electronic records. No paper. I mean no paper, because there's no insurance piece. There is no filing. Do you know how much money goes into filing and insurance in the U.S. medical system? It's done. She's treated on the spot that day with a combination of herbs and Western medication with no bias, which gives her an incredibly inexpensive treatment. While I was there, I decided to have some ultrasounds because I could. I walked in, I got treated the same day. The person who did the ultrasounds was a PhD MD with 20 years of experience, not a tech. She talked the entire time we were there and gave me a running update and then analyzed my ultrasound before I left the room. I had 9 ultrasounds. I had everything done, both kidneys, liver, gallbladder, prostate, thyroid, carotid arteries, femoral arteries. The cost, and I do not have Chinese medical insurance, the cost was $27. They found a cyst in my kidney. I came back and finally convinced my doc I wanted it checked. I actually had to tell her that I had a tremendous amount of pain. She checked it. It took me several weeks to get scheduled at a cost of over $700 to find exactly the same results they found in China for about $3 or $4 for that one ultrasound. Right. Now, one of the reasons they can do this, they turn out more doctors than we do, which begs the question, why don't we turn out more doctors? You know how many people would like to go to medical school and don't go? In China, they go to medical school. Only 5% of doctors or people in medical school, when interviewed, said they're going to be general practitioners. We don't have enough doctors. They'd have tort reform. You don't sue. There is no malpractice insurance. If a doctor makes a mistake, the licensing board does what they need to do them with them, and someone would sue the doctor directly and get money, but it almost never happens. So they don't have to practice defensive medicine. One of my staff got a bite on her lip, went to the emergency room. The doctor never touched her, said, pull down your lip. She went like this. He said, okay, I don't think we're going to do stitches. Never touched her, gave her a tetanus shot. The nurse gave a tetanus shot. It was $1,500. In China, when I was there, I walked down the corridor, and there's a big room with people sitting. It was very hot. I was there in July and June. Very hot, and people are sitting there watching TV with IVs on. And I said, what's this, the cancer ward? And he goes, no, those are people that got dehydrated, so they came in to get hydrated. Probably cost 50 cents to get a bag of saline put into them while they watch TV. Here, do you know what that emergency room visit would cost? The voice of experience. Yes, I have many of those experiences. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to open up. I wanted to talk a little bit about education versus propaganda, but I'm sure that will come up during the rest of this. So we're going to open it up for questions. By the way, I have about four times more than that to talk about, so we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, two things. Usage in geriatrics and Len Saputo over your way. If you contacted him or collaborated in any way?
I have. Len and I see a lot of the same patients. I was out at his health medicine center 2 weeks ago. My wife is okay that I tell people this. I took her out so that she could get a thermogram, a breast thermogram. Most of my patients, my female patients, I recommend they get thermograms because I think it is by far the best technology to, for breast issues, much, much superior to mammograms. I mean, the mortality rate of women that do mammograms versus self-exams is exactly the same. You understand that? And the risk from mammograms is about 1% cancer increase per mammogram. So thermograms are totally safe. Anyway, while I was there, he actually did a treatment on me with his photon stimulator. So yes, we do. And what was the other? Geriatrics? Yeah, geriatrics. Yeah, when I was in China, I studied with a guy who has ALS, which is generally fatal in a very short period of time. He was diagnosed 14 years ago, and he's still practicing. He sees 50 patients a day. And geriatrics there is practiced very differently. There are formulas that have, there's one formula that is hundreds of years old that was studied by 1,200 PhD biochemists to see exactly how it worked. This is not folk medicine. 1,500 researchers, and it is the primary geriatric formula used in China. One thing to remember is the standard of care for most things in China is herbal medicine. Acupuncture is secondary. Yeah, question. Yeah.
Actually,
Dave.
Oh, Sally.
Hi, Sally.
I have two questions. One relates to the healthcare program going on right now.
Uh-huh.
Is there
My
anybody?
Wife made me promise not to get political tonight.
This isn't political. It's just, I just... Is there anybody from the Chinese medicine area that participates in the advising of how to reform healthcare, or do you know?
There was one small group of people that met on the periphery. There's absolutely nothing in any of the healthcare reform, and I mean nothing, that has anything to do with traditional Chinese medicine or herbal medicine, et cetera. Nothing.
Would it help if we contacted our senators?
Well, I think we should do something.
Yeah,
again, to me, this is not a political issue. And again, the 900-pound gorilla is any system of health care will work if we cut costs by 50%. Yeah. And I see, honestly, nothing, absolutely nothing anywhere in the health reform bills that will actually cut costs. So somebody's going to have to pay for that, and it's going to be a heavy, heavy burden on whoever does. So I think it's a very, very important issue.
And then I have one more question that relates to a disease. That, would some sort of Chinese medicine help somebody that has scleroderma?
I've treated scleroderma successfully on several occasions. It depends on whether it's on the, if it's more superficial or if it's already in the organs. Obviously, if it's in the organs, it's much more difficult. But there are very successful treatments for even organ-based scleroderma. But, I mean, nothing's 100%, but there are very effective treatments. Yes, sir?
Now the time is to ask questions. Would Chinese medicine have any solution to dry mouth, dry throat?
Oh, sure. We treat, there are treatments for Sjogren's syndrome, for post-radiation dry mouth. I have two patients right now who have very dry mouth. In fact, one of them may be here from radiation therapies done for mouth cancer, and very effective herbal treatments. Not so much acupuncture, a little bit acupuncture, but really the herbal treatments are far superior. So it's actually, that's a very well-known treatment in China. Yes.
Yes, in China, what percentage of the doctors practice TCM and what percentage of the doctors practice Western medicine?
That's a great question to which I do not know the answer on a percentage basis. There are three types of licensure. There's TCM licensure, there is typical biomedical licensure, and there's a combined licensure. Most of the people that I studied with had both, although I did study with both. The person that I did my integrated diabetes protocol, and trust me, I gave the vignette for the gynecology, or at least a little bit. It's far more dramatic in the diabetes protocols. They do education on a level that is unimaginable here. In every hospital in China now, that's their new policy, but I was at the hospital at the start of that. They have what's called Diabetes Day, and someone like me would stand up here and talk about diabetes, and then someone would get up on stage and for about this many people and do exercise physiology, get everybody moving and teach them some exercises. Then someone else would come up and talk about seasonal eating for diabetes. And then down this wall would be a row of Western medical doctors and traditional Chinese medical doctors. And everybody in that room would go through a screening with all of those doctors. So they would have an ophthalmologist look at their eyes. They would have a Chinese medical doctor examine what we do, tongues and pulses, etc. They would have someone look at their feet. They would screen the men for erectile dysfunction, etc. That happens every month. Every month. Those people are screened in those protocols. And what we know, if you look at weight loss programs, for example, we know the programs that typically work the best are the ones where you have a cohort of people that come together and support each other. If you look at almost any training program or exercise program, if you can get people together, your chances of success go up very dramatically, and that's what they're doing in China. Yes?
Yes. Why does the government restrict the number of children per family, yet the services for children for childbirth are so readily available and affordable?
In China?
Yes.
That's a question that, again, I don't know the answer to. I mean, there's certainly some political issues, but the idea is that at 6 billion people on the planet, they don't feel that the planet can support more people, and that's a way of doing that, is to limit the number of births. And that is not an absolute. There is a one-child policy, but there are many, many extenuating circumstances where people may have more than one child. One of my professors, who hadn't been in China for quite a while, he was actually in the first cohort of new acupuncturists after Mao. When he went to China, and when he came back, a lot of the students said, "What do you think is the worst thing happening in China?" And they listed all these things. And he said, "The one-child policy." He said it's creating an entire country of little emperors because, imagine, you know how you have all the grandparents, all the aunts and uncles, mom and dad are putting all of their attention on this one child. And so what used to be the child taking care of the parents, and that's expected actually, it's a legal responsibility in some ways, now they're all putting all of their attention on this one child, and so it's becoming quite a problem. Now, again, there are the reasons for it, and the validity, we could go on forever, but that's basically it. Yeah?
I was curious how you began your interest in Chinese medicine.
Yeah, I think like most people my age, which is old, it's different now. There are a lot of people coming right out of college going into acupuncture. But in my, most of the people in my age had been old hippies that needed to kind of get back into the culture and wanted to do some healing, and it was an easy way to get a license. It's not so easy anymore, but a lot of it was that. And I think most of us did it because of our personal experience. For me, I was at UC Berkeley. I'd been a high school athlete, became a couch potato, and one day couldn't get out of a chair. I'd blown a disc in my back. I was in absolute agony. I had two opinions. Both said I had to have surgery. There was just no two ways about it. I was going to have the surgery, and I had one friend who was very eclectic and far more intelligent than I, and he read everything. And he said, "Why don't you go try acupuncture?" And I said, "What is that?" Right? This is early 70s. And he goes, "That's where they, you know, remember the Kung Fu TV show where they stick the needles in you?" I said, "I'm not going to let anybody do that." And he said, "So let me get this straight. You're going to let them take a scalpel and carve up your spine?" I said, "Let me think about it." And so, indeed, I went in. And what shocked me, I didn't even get acupuncture. This man did herbal treatments. He changed my entire diet. He actually changed my sexual habits. He made me make some agreements for 6 months, which I was 21. This was not easy. And, anyway, I won't go into the details. And he had me start learning Tai Chi Chuan and Qigong. I haven't had the surgery. My back is now better than it has ever been since I was probably 20 years old. My second thing was, about 20 years later, I, through a life of debauchery, developed some very, very severe chemical sensitivities and food allergies. I didn't know what was wrong with me, but I went to but it was excruciating. I would actually black out, I would pass out, I would go into anaphylactic shock from the pain in my gut. And I was very fortunate. I was up in Reno. I was playing poker for a living at the time. And my dad happened to be up there, rushed me to the hospital, and they said another 10 minutes I probably wouldn't have made it because I was in anaphylaxis. So I started, you know, I went through all the Western things one would think of, finding my GI doc. Now, this is a few years ago, so diagnostic techniques were not as good as they are now, okay? But he said, "We have to do surgery. You have a tumor." And I was relieved. It's like, "Oh, thank God, they found out what it is." And I said, "How do you know?" And he said, "Well, we don't. It's exploratory." I went back to the little guy that treated me before. He gave me herbs, told me to stay out of the casinos, and within 1 week, the problem had gone away. The problem was it took me 20 years of study to actually find out what was wrong with me so that I can now treat my patients. So those were the two biggies. The third one was my dad developed throat cancer. I went back to North Dakota. I'd learned to play guitar while he's gone, and I sang to him. We got all the neighbors in. I cooked for him. I made raw foods for him. He was well enough. He couldn't even get out of his chair when I got there. We drove him out here. I wasn't an acupuncturist, so I took him to a clinic. They treated him. He was in remarkably good health. He went to his World War II reunion and then went back to North Dakota. The doc examined him and said, "Oh, my God, this is amazing. The cancer, the tumor is less than half as big as it was before, but we're going to operate anyway," and he died during surgery. Well, that's not uncommon. I mean, yeah, so that's how most people like myself got into this medicine. It's just after dozens, in many cases, of experiences like that. And again, that's not anything wrong with, none of these is meant to say anything anyway, negative about biomedicine. They do what they do. Our emphasis is completely different. Chinese medicine is extremely brilliant qualitatively. We see qualities. Western biomedicine is extremely brilliant quantitatively. Their testing is brilliant. Their ability to do their lab tests. I use Western lab tests every day in my clinic. I love them. It's like, you know, I can tell that something's wrong, but then I get the lab test and I get a number, right? It's really handy stuff. So, again, in China, it's the marriage of those without bias that allows them to deliver high-quality health care for 5% what we do here. The other thing to remember is there's this illusion that China has socialized medicine. We spend 100 times more, approximately, per patient for government-paid health care than the Chinese do. The Chinese pay cash out of their pocket for most of their health care. In fact, they pay a lower percentage per person than the government pays here. So this is not a function of socialized medicine. It's a function of inexpensive medicine that people can actually afford. Yes?
I was intrigued with your slide on nutrition.
Yes.
And specifically the bullet points on colors of food.
You got that?
I whipped those.
Yeah, I actually pulled up an article the other day from, you know, I get, I don't know, 10, 12 at least nutritional newsletters, and I get Medscape for Western medicine, et cetera. And three or four times in the last month, these authors have made these brilliant breakthroughs linking the color of vegetables and fruits to their healing qualities, right? Well, the Chinese did that about 6,000 years ago, right? And that, their medicine has not changed. That's one of the values of it. They don't. It's not. It doesn't change. And so we know that different antioxidants, different biochemical compounds have different colors, right? The proanthocyanidins are generally bluish purple, and they have very powerful antioxidant qualities, right? White vegetables and fruits have are generally very high in quercetin and a variety of other antioxidants. And it's not coincidental that those foods come into season at different times of year, that the green foods come in. Right, and then you see the summer foods, and then we start getting into the more white foods, and then the very, very high beta-carotene-rich orange, red, yellow foods, right? And we go through that cycle. And we, as human beings, adapted to that. And the more we resist it, the worse our health is. And so that color, so most Chinese medical nutrition is based on temperature qualities. Every food and every herb has a temperature quality of how it affects the body. Again, looking at yin and yang, and it will have in foods, the color is critical. So for example, if you were going to eat meat, every meat has a different temperature quality. Lamb is very heating, and some people it's not good for because it overheats them. Partially we know now it's because of the types of fat in lamb that are different. Pork is very cooling. Beef is actually pretty neutral. So as we look at these things, we can look at the best foods for different people because the food that I need to eat to stay balanced is not the same as a 100-pound frail woman who's freezing to death. I don't get cold. I would have worn shorts today, but my wife made me put on my pants along with my bolo tie. Yes?
One last question. I've talked with a lot of Western doctors and explained that I'm seeing an acupuncturist, and the reception has ranged from sort of, oh, well, that's nice, you're doing something to supplement the care, to, well, what are you seeing that kind of doctor, that kind of right. practitioner for? I think it's really a shame that acupuncture and Western medicine don't communicate more in this country. What sorts of things do you think could be done to start bridging that gap?
There are currently some medical schools that require, it's a very short, but it's at least there, a short course for medical doctors to teach them a little bit, a few hours, about other medical systems. What do chiropractors do? What do acupuncturists do, et cetera, which at least gives them an inkling. And again, we have to look at propaganda, right? That's really what we're looking at here. And when we look at medical studies, and again, I have about 2,000 on here, on vitamin D alone. Okay, vitamin D, there are 3,000 studies released this year on vitamin D and health, mostly on immune function. I have 826 studies on one document of vitamin D and ultraviolet light and its relationship to preventing cancer. The National Institutes of Health, which are the gods of health in the U.S., their sponsored study showed that women that take moderate amounts of vitamin D for 5 years, menopausal women, have 77% fewer cancers. 77, you know how much we spend on cancer in this country? That one ingredient, which is pennies, literally about 4 cents a day that it would cost to use that. 2 weeks, 3 weeks after that study came out, the National Cancer Institute came out and said, we do not recommend any supplements to prevent cancer. That same week in Canada, they quadrupled their recommendation for vitamin D intake. So we're dealing here with a level of propaganda. It doesn't, again, I had a couple studies that I was going to go look at here. One, though, is called WAX. Antioxidants are proven to be a bust in cardiovascular care. Now, this is in Medscape, and I use that because Medscape is the newsletter for doctors and nurses. In Medscape, if you have an article where 100 people died in a study, it'll have an article like, oh, this drug may be a problem, right? They don't use pejorative language. They said this was a bust, right? And almost all of the antioxidant or natural medicine studies are given that type of title. If you actually look at the study, which I do, wasn't for prevention. These were people that were expected to die from cardiovascular disease. They didn't use antioxidants. They used synthetic vitamins at such a low dose you wouldn't expect to get a result. And in the vitamin D arm alone, in all five endpoint measurements, vitamin D did better than the placebo. In the vitamin C study, and I have this on here, it's a quote that I didn't get to, it lowered the mortality rate by 31%. 31%. That's earth-shaking. The lead author said, we decided to throw those results out because we can't explain them. That's why medical doctors have no idea, because they're reading those headlines. I have about 20 studies here on statin drugs. It's been well proven that statin drugs increase mortality in women by about 14% if they're not diabetic. The studies by the top medical ethicist, one of them in the country, Ted Eisenberger, says there is no support. There's never been a study that actually showed that statins were valuable for women. And at the other hand, there's a very high rate that they have proven of muscle death in women, even though it's not detected on lab studies. When they do biopsy, women that complain of pain after doing statins and have negative lab results for what they would look for, when they do muscle biopsy, 56% of them had muscle death. Okay, now here we have muscle death versus clear evidence that the statins are actually more dangerous, but statins are constantly being prescribed for women. It's propaganda. Statin studies that show a positive result are reported 6 times more often in medical journals than statin studies that show a negative result. So that's why. Yes?
I have a question. It was broken down to me at one point by an acupuncturist, 2 sets of information for Chinese medicine, one before the communist revolution and one after. The one after having certain intuitive and you could call spiritual elements thrown out. Do you have any perspective on that? And if so,
yeah,
how has it filtered?
I feel very blessed that several of my teachers were pre-Maoist acupuncturists. And I've studied with a lot of people that were there at that transition and or who studied with pre-Maoist acupuncturists. And there's a huge difference. Indeed, being an atheistic country, any mention, in fact, there was no, you could not have an emotionally oriented disease like depression, anxiety, etc. It was not legal, okay? Because you were in the workers' paradise, so you couldn't possibly depress. So you see this in the literature. Those terms couldn't even be used. And that, so post-Mao. So pre-Maoist, and again, it's not just that delineation. Again, we have thousands of years, and there were big turning points in the evolution of Chinese medicine. There was a book called the Shanghanlun written in the 2nd century that was the Bible of herbal medicine. But at some point, it stopped being as useful because it was talking about how to treat an agrarian culture. But then in about 1200, we saw the beginnings of diabetes and chronic disease, internally engendered diseases, we would call them, that were very complex. And then you saw a big shift in how medicine was practiced in China, but certainly a big one with Mao. I mean, again, the names of the acupuncture points were actually changed to take out any spiritual connotations.
Mm-hmm. Is it just luck to find these lines of information from pre-Mao if you want to learn this method, or is there a way?
Oh, no, there are people. Not just luck. You can look. You can find them. There are some very, very, very good teachers that are teaching. They've gone back to the classics. Right, they've kind of said, okay, there's all this information. Now, one of the values of TCM, or this post-Maoist medicine, is it's very science-based. So it really appeals to a lot of people. You have a lot of validation for how it works and what works. And the spirit can be lost, a lot of the spirit. It still works. But you can go back to the classics and read the classics, and there are some brilliant teachers out now teaching just the classics. So you can certainly find them. And it is. It's a different approach and very effective. Yes?
I
Yeah.
So we should all take vitamin C and vitamin D. What are some other simple things that we can do as individuals to keep our contact with our health care practitioners down, and that would also help, as a society, reduce those health care costs?
Mostly, it's all the things that you all already know, right? Meditation. Doesn't have to be formal meditation. Some place where you surrender your need to control reality, okay, and put your attention on the energetic and or non-energetic systems that are occurring. Sleeping enough. We don't sleep enough. It's, you know, you look at the bell curve on death, and people that don't sleep enough die faster. You know, it's really simple. To eat organic. I mean, we are in a country, you know, there are several hundred, actually several thousand, but a couple of hundred known carcinogens that are in our food all the time. Labeling is very inaccurate. So that type of thing, to eat organic, grow a garden, you know, eat only organic food. And exercise. Tai Chi is the single best exercise to prevent osteoporosis. There's nothing even close to it, actually. But any kind of exercise, half an hour a day, will lower your blood pressure by 15 points. Yes?
I wanted to add, sort of against what you said,
uh-huh.
I haven't had an ounce of chicken, fish, or meat in 40-plus years, and I think that perhaps it might be part of what you're talking about, but maybe not. I don't.
No, and again, there are many forms. Again, in Chinese medicine, there is no one-size-fits-all. And that's really critical. If you go to a Western nutritionist or if you go to a Western doctor, frequently it's a one-size. If you come in and explain your symptoms, they can stand. In fact, there are call-in doctors that will prescribe for you, right? They've never seen you. They've never done any tests. You give them a couple symptoms, and they send you some drugs, okay? In Chinese medicine, we can't even do that. We can't even. It's beyond our imagination. And so there are people that I recommend they stop eating meat. There are other people I tell them they're not going to get pregnant unless they start eating meat or fish. And it's, I'll tell you what, I can show you study after study. Vegetarian women on average have children who are 8 to 10 IQ points lower. That can be changed very easily if they will just take fish oil. Right, but I have trouble getting my vegetarian women. These are studies. These are very well proven. They're all over the place. So if I get a vegetarian mom, she's going to promise me to take her fish oil. Okay, because the DHA, the primary fat in one of the two primary fats in fish oil, docosahexaenoic acid, about 50% of the brain is fat, and about 50% of that is DHA. And baby's brain is the fastest growing part of his body. And if baby isn't getting DHA, which comes through the milk, the brain doesn't develop properly. And if mom doesn't have DHA coming in, there's none to go out in the milk. So it's okay if you're a vegetarian, but you have to take then other thing, B12. I can't tell you how many B12 deficient vegetarians I see, particularly women, and DHA deficient. So again, to us, one person I might say, yeah, stop eating meat. Another person I'd say, I think you need to eat a lot more meat, right? Another person I'm going to say, eat cold foods. Another person I'm going to say, don't ever put a piece of raw vegetable in your mouth, right? So it's a difference. It's all individual. Anything? You can let me out? Yes. The Japanese and Chinese cultures, as you probably know, have come together and then separated and then come together and separated, much like the Chinese and Indian cultures. And Japanese culture, there was a period where there were changes in the Chinese medical system and they weren't in contact with the Japanese. So the Japanese are actually working on an older system primarily. And they practice herbally what's called Kampo medicine, which, by the way, 75% of the doctors in Japan, the medical doctors, give herbs, Kampo herbs. Why? Because it's cheaper, it's more effective, and there are no side effects. And so in Japan, you'll see that. In terms of acupuncture, we're operating on the same theory, but I would say the technique is much different. In China, particularly post-Mao, they got into this no pain, no gain thing, and they started using bigger and bigger needles and doing more and more stimulation. Often, now I don't practice that, by the way. I'm pre-Maoist in my technique. However, I do have patients that will ask me for Japanese technique, which means I don't want to feel the needle at all. And in Japanese technique, they use very tiny needles. Sometimes they don't even insert the needles. And so it's very different technique-wise, but no difference really in spirit or really the basics. Okay, I guess they're going to cut me off. Thank you.
Well, many thanks to Dr. John Needers, Doctor of Acupuncture and Oriental Medicines, for his comments today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you.